Chances are that if you're currently teaching, or if you've taught in the past 5 years, you have students who are not yet fluent in English. So how do you position multilingual students? If you're having trouble answering this question, you're not alone. The math education world talks a lot about positioning students for success. But what exactly is positioning? Turns out that the definition of positioning is not just about the physical location of one student versus another. The type of positioning involved with ensuring students know that they are competent and capable involves the labels a teacher assigns to students and the asset-based or deficit-based lens that an adult places upon a child. It involves the roles, the rights, and responsibilities of children. So answering questions such as, do students see themselves as leaders or as someone who always needs help from others? Are students I serve allowed to share their thoughts and opinions in class? Or are they rarely called upon to share their thinking with others? I also invite you to ask yourself, what kinds of assumptions am I making about students? And why am I making these assumptions? Today's episode explores these ideas and how our actions as parents and educators influence how children see themselves through an explanation of something known as positioning theory. While this theory influences many demographics, our guest, Dr. Catherine Cheval, who is the current dean of the College of Education for the University of Illinois, Chicago, and author of 18 books and over 50 research publications, has spent decades researching the intersection of positioning theory with multilingual learners as they are engaging with mathematics. If you're a teacher, get your entire grade level team together to listen to this episode and talk through the strategies mentioned afterward. If you're a parent, make sure your child's teacher and principal are both aware of this episode in particular, because all students deserve to be positioned for success. Welcome to the Kids Math Talk podcast, where in each episode, we give parents and educators practical tips and insights that will deepen mathematical understanding while also encouraging the conversation about math to remain active and positive. I'm your host, Desiree Harrison, elementary math coach and Kids Math Talk founder. Today on the Kids Math Talk podcast, we have the lead author of the new book, Teaching Math to Multilingual Students, Grades K through 8. Please welcome Catherine Cheval.
Thank you, Desiree. I appreciate it. Wonderful to be here today and listen to you and talk with you, and hopefully others will listen as well.
So that is the goal at Kids Math Talk, and we're here to keep the conversation active and positive, and also to make connections, to make things that are happening in the math education world more accessible to educators and to parents who might not be in different organizations and who might not be reading all the same materials, because we're stronger together. Part of the title, actually, that I hadn't said yet, is positioning English language learners for success. And that word positioning, we hear a lot, and we're hearing it a lot more as districts and schools are thinking and talking more about equitable access. And this word positioning just is becoming a buzzword, but it's not necessarily being defined. And so we're getting different interpretations of what it means. And I've even had some teachers engage in conversations with me about that word, thinking that it's physical positioning of students around the room, which is one definition of the word, but that's not necessarily what is meant by your text. So to start us off, tell us about what positioning students means and why this is so important.
I've done a lot of professional development with teachers across the country. And in recent years, I've done 60 hours around teaching multilingual learners with groups of teachers. So they're like, you know, I've had professional development on using visuals or other types of strategies. And out of all of the topics, the one topic that they're like, I've never had this before, is positioning. So when we first did the first session, it was 3 hours. And then they asked for 3 more hours. So there is great interest in positioning. I think some people assume it's a physical positioning in a classroom. So I'll tell a story from my experiences as a child in math. Some practices that used to be used in math classes, we don't use anymore. But in this particular classroom, the students were physically positioned. The seating chart was changed after every exam. And so the best students were in the front row. And so that was a competitive model, right? Everybody wanted to be in desk number one because that was the highest performer. So this was very public in that classroom. And children were physically positioned based on their performance. So oftentimes, there are so many words in our language that have multiple meanings. And that's one of the reasons why English is so interesting. And positions and positioning is one of those words that has multiple meanings. But when we're talking about positioning children, we're drawing on positioning theory. And so I'll talk a little bit about that in three concepts that I think it's very important for parents and for teachers to recognize. I think one of the other things to keep in mind is that positioning is in every environment we're in. So parents position their children, siblings position each other. I was one of seven children. I was the sixth of seven. And so my birth order, that brought some positioning moves in my family, I would say. So positioning theory, I've learned the most from the research by Ron Huray and Luke Van Langenhove and their books and articles on positioning theory. And so I want to break this down and talk about three different concepts. So this is out of social psychology, and I think all three are important. So the three are positions, storylines, and acts. And so you could see, think about in your own experiences, have you ever heard someone say something like, wow, that child's a handful, or that girl's really bossy? So years ago, I went to a women's leadership conference and they said, you know, 8-year-old girls who are future leaders are often labeled as bossy, but that does not happen to boys. I thought that is so true. I remember that when I was in schools, like girls were the bossy ones. So we get these labels, right? These roles that are assigned to children. And sometimes you can assign roles yourself or position yourself too. But so these are really important things because there's the positions, you can think of those as roles, rights, duties. And so in studying effective teachers, I've seen them position multilingual learners as teachers, as role models, as contributors, as family members, as listeners. These are all roles we want children to have. In a deficit perspective, you know, we might have language of, you know, this is a remedial student. This is the student that always needs help. This is the student that struggles in math. And so as we enter into relationships with children, as we're trying to assess where they are, it's very careful that we approach each child with an asset-based lens and not a deficit lens. Because if you're approaching a child with a deficit lens and you're going to position them in that way, it's going to influence everything that you do with that child. So the position that, think of it as the roles, the rights, the responsibilities that might be in a classroom.
So what I wrote down was the word position and then all of these different arrows shooting out of that and then connecting all of that with identity.
This is heavily connected with identity, yes.
Well, I guess even if you're not positioning, you are positioning. So if you're not addressing these areas, you still are by ignoring them or believing that they don't exist.
Exactly. So it's not if you position, it's how you position. And so sometimes this is deliberate and a lot of times it's not deliberate. And so it's inadvertent. And so it's recognizing that. Silence can position someone. So, you know, you can think about eye movements. How many times have you been in a meeting and someone is speaking and other people are rolling their eyes, right? Children do that, right? That's communicating something. It doesn't involve speech in any way in terms of words, but it obviously is communicating something in a message. Yeah, what I tell people is this is a blessing and a curse. I now look at positioning in every setting I'm in. I'm looking at how people are positioning themselves. I'm looking at how others are positioning. There's repositioning. So someone might try and assign you a position. You like exert yourself and try and reposition yourself. That happens too. And they talk about that in the theory. So The other thing I think that's really important is that as I've worked with teachers over years, they've changed their perspectives and they've changed how they've treated children. So I've worked with teachers who have started with a deficit lens and positioned these children specifically in deficit ways. And in the end, they were their biggest cheerleaders. So, I do want to say, you know, this teacher's perspectives, parents' perspectives can change when they have a new understanding of the role that positioning plays in learning and teaching. So I think that's an important point to make.
I want to do a lot more research about discretionary spaces, but this like has me thinking positioning is interconnected with discretionary spaces.
I would say it's in every space. You know, it influences the development of children's academic competence. So in my field, mathematics, their social competence with other people, and their communicative competence. And so all three of those are really critical in a math classroom. And it also influences their participation. So, you know, I've been in classrooms where you have a multilingual learner that doesn't say a word for an entire year. They're spectators. And so we want to position every child, no matter what background they have, to be a contributor and a someone that participates, not a spectator in mathematics.
So would that entail the teacher, whoever the person of authority might be, like I use that in quotes, like might be in the classroom, to assist in the repositioning of that child because that child themselves might not know how to advocate for themselves? So then that plays into what a teacher believes. And you were talking about how teachers' beliefs, the more you talk about this, can change. But is it likely, I guess, that a child who sees themselves only as a spectator would be able to reposition themselves without the assistance of the teacher?
Well, I have two thoughts there. The first thought I would have is I think it would be extremely difficult. I think it's possible, but I think it's extremely difficult without the teacher having specific actions to change those narratives. So that's one thing I would say. I also think that in a classroom of, let's say, 24 students, the teacher's not always going to be there for an individual child. They're going to be working with somebody else. Like, that's the reality. So one of the things that we talk about is that we have to get every child, you know, over time in a place where they can advocate for themselves. So we published one study of a child that was bullied at the beginning of the year. And at the end, we see evidence of him standing up for himself mathematically. So in the beginning of the year, he's working with a partner to play a math game. The partner moves the board so that the partner can see it rather than the multilingual learner. It's upside down. His partner moves all the pieces for him, tells him what to do. You know, this child has no agency in this whole situation, right? And then at the end of the year, after a significant intervention with this teacher, at the end of the year, he's working with a partner on a computer and they're debating the mathematical answer. And his partner is telling him he's got the wrong answer when the multilingual learner has the right answer. And finally, he says, "Do you want to bet?" This is a third grader, you know, so an 8, 9-year-old. And so he has learned over the course of the year, you know what, the teacher has showed me how to advocate for myself, how I know what I'm doing mathematically, and I can, you know, say something about that in a polite way, you know. So, but yes, I think that in most cases, this requires someone that's going to help these children learn how to do this.
I just think about a classroom that I'm working in currently and the children who do not say anything, but they will type. Like on Jamboard, we use the sticky notes. They will type on that, but they will not turn their mic on. That's still communication. So.
That's still communication. Yeah.
Loving this podcast? Great. Subscribe so you know when new episodes are released. And leave us a review on Apple so that others can find these episodes. We are stronger together.
So the first part was positions. The second one I'll go to is acts. Now, in the theory, some write this in different ways. They'll refer to it as speech acts or communication acts. But sometimes speech is not involved, or communication, people assume it's speaking or, you know, writing. And so it can be silence, for example. So I'm more using this term acts. So it can be gestures, you know, it can be speaking, writing, lots of different ways we communicate, right? And so as we think about things that people do and do not do, this would fall into this category. One of the things that I've learned with multilingual learners in U.S. classrooms is too often, you know, I've been doing this now for multiple decades, that too often they were positioned through a deficit lens. And so a lot of my work was, how do we eliminate that approach, that view, that perspective in classrooms? And so you can see some of the language that we talk about in the media, social media, that's deficit-based. Learning loss is big right now with COVID, for example. So two words I've tried to eliminate from my speech is help and need. And so a colleague of mine at the University of Missouri, Professor Zandra Dayaraja, she was looking at, when you looked up English learners online, you know, what are kind of the verbs that, you know, people are talking about? And it's always about helping and supporting, nothing about challenging, you know, and those kinds of things. So, you know, she really opened my eyes to the verbs we're using around these kiddos matters. And so, you know, as I've worked with teachers, you know, Andrea, you help Jose. They're like, what's wrong with that? I mean, this is something that, you know, even my conversation with preschool teachers, you know, they're always talking about helpers, like, who are my friends? Who are my helpers? You know, but helpers is a big one. But what oftentimes is that it was the multilingual learners that were always positioned as the ones that needed help. And it was assumed they needed help. They didn't even ask for help. And so what does that convey to the child? And so when you started to ask the children, you know, what would they say to you? Well, the teacher doesn't think I can do it. And so, you know, we make assumptions about specific children that we're not necessarily making to other children. So in one study I did, I looked at Asian children versus children from Central America. And the teachers assumed the children from Asia would be gifted and need challenge in math, and the children from Central America would be remedial and need help. And it was only based with no information about the country of origin or the continent of origin, for example.
So assumptions get us in so much trouble. Not yes. just in the mathematical classroom, but just in our daily lives. And to think that we all have implicit bias, but being aware of that and overcoming our assumptions to actually sit down with the child to see what they actually do know, to get some formative assessment data on them to help inform appropriate instruction for wherever they might be right now, instead of just assuming that they need help.
You know, so we've had teachers, when they partner kids, say, you know, you go this child's speed, you know, you go slow today because you're going to be working with this multilingual learner, right? So we want to eliminate all of those messages explicitly. Multilingual learners not being allowed to select their partners when everybody else in the room is. You're just separating these children from how they're treated from the other children. And that conveys, you know, messages to children. So these acts can be silence. So I have teachers that have said, I don't call on my multilingual learners because I'm afraid I'm not going to understand what they're saying to me. So they just don't call on them. And so there, that's a silence, right? That is an act, even though there's no speech or writing involved there. And I am so grateful to teachers that I've worked with that they're willing to, you know, A, they want to work with me and say, I want to get better at this. They're blatantly honest. They cry when they realize that they've been doing things that they consider to be not in the best interest of children, because teachers want what's best for kids. So, you know, they said, why didn't I learn this, you know, when I was learning to be a teacher? I'm like, you know, this is really core. And so I'm glad that it's finally making its way into classrooms and teachers are talking about this.
I remember in my undergraduate experience taking a psychology course, but it was more so just about the psychologists that you hear so much about, like Skinner and like Vygotsky. And you don't hear about all these other
theories and how they really will impact you in the classroom. And it's unfortunate, but at least we, if we can get in the mindset that we're always continuing to learn and evolve, then we can have like conversations like right now with you and reading books like what you've written and other articles that we can think about and just reflect on what we used to do and know that we aren't that same person or we don't have to be that same person. We don't know what we don't know until we seek it out and have and be open and have be vulnerable and have conversations and know that we're not perfect.
Yep. We're, I've been doing this a long time and I've never learned more about children. I mean, this study we did, we started putting video cameras on kids' heads in 2005, and that was before wearable technology. And so we rigged them on the bill of caps and seeing the classroom as the children saw them, that's when this opened my eyes to things I had never seen before. And then we played the videotapes each week for the teachers and, you know, they were seeing things for the first time. So, you know, I wish I would have known this when I started my third grade teaching career, but you know, you learn along the way, you get better. And that's what we're always hoping for. You know, my parenting now, I'm a better grandparent than I was a parent. You know, so constantly, you know, talking to my daughter about, you know, my grandkids and things like that. So the first one was positions, right? So duties, roles, responsibilities, you might think of that. Communication acts or acts. So we might think of verbal talk, actions, gestures, nonverbal communication, silence. Yeah, I think the one thing I'd add about gestures and working with teachers is they became more intentional and strategic about the use of them. So it wasn't just pointing, you know, but there's this one video clip where the teacher is introducing a story about her young daughter at the park and doing an obstacle course, you know, and she's using her hands to show the tire and to go, you know, crawl through the obstacle course. And the multilingual learners at the beginning, they're wearing their head cameras, were like, I don't know what an obstacle course is. And at the end, they go, oh, yeah, I love that. You know, and it's like they're her gestures sold. Now, she could have put an image up. That's the thing when you're teaching. Sometimes you have a video. Sometimes you have a photo. And sometimes you just don't have time for that or you didn't think about it ahead of time. And you use gestures to convey something. So they all have different purposes. They all take different amounts of time and preparation. But all of them, it isn't just about pointing to things and using color. So using color in the images we're using, tracing, you know, like perimeter, whatever might be tracing something. All those gestures can be so helpful with teaching mathematics.
And you can use gestures even if you're virtual. You can hold your hand up in the camera and same with them. And and if they're not turning their camera on, if you still have your camera on, they can at least see what you're doing. And they might be doing it at home too. They just don't have their camera turned on.
Yeah, I heard a story last week that there was a multilingual learner that wasn't turning their camera on. And so when the teacher had a conversation with the child, he said, you know, well, no one in my home speaks English, you know, and so they had, you know, they kind of had mute, they were muted. And, you know, the other children will see that my family doesn't speak English. And so it's assumptions that we might make about why people are doing what they're doing. And so they then had this conversation, the class had a conversation because more than 50% of the class is multilingual. And so they had this conversation about their homes and, you know, my family doesn't speak English, you know, and all of a sudden this kid's like, I had no idea all these other kids had were in homes that they didn't speak English. And all of a sudden this kid's got the microphone on and the video on, but it was just that initial conversation the teacher had one-on-one with this child to just to understand. And then, you know, maybe the child will make different choices based on having more information. So.
Yeah, that's amazing. And it sounds like the turnaround was so quick. They just didn't realize.
Yeah. And so then when all the other kids were like, yeah, we don't speak English in my house. And so then all of a sudden they had, you know, this was someone that just moved. And so all of a sudden they're thrown into this new environment and kids make assumptions too. We all make assumptions. So can we start engaging them in conversations and trying to understand? And maybe the mic needs to stay off but maybe they'll become more comfortable and make different choices. And so how do we just ensure their success and make sure they understand that they're not alone?
I'm taking a quick break to remind Kids Math Talk listeners about all of the math professional development books that are available through Corwin Mathematics at us.corwin.com. Many of the authors of some of the latest titles have been guests on the podcast, including the authors featured in today's episode. Want free shipping? Of course you do. Then use our special code KMTSHIP. That's KMTSHIP, all caps, at checkout. Now let's get back to the interview.
Position can be as much about what the teacher does not do as it is about the acts that they do. So we have to keep that in mind. And so an absence of appropriate acts can do the same damage as the outright negative acts. And that's hard to kind of come to grips with. So a researcher, Yoon, in 2008 published a study, and she argued that the main reason for multilingual learners' anxiety, silence, and different positioning has to do with being outsiders in the regular classroom context. So, you know, I often engage teachers in a conversation about, you know, how do we ensure these children are not outsiders? They're not on the boundaries in the classroom. They're insiders. So when I talk to my pre-service teachers that I teach at the university, oftentimes they'll say, well, I'm going to work with these kids during lunch and after school or during recess. And again, it's not about how do you make them become part of the community. It's about isolating them. So it's really important that teachers have strategies and are strategic about how they help these children become insiders with their peers.
When you said at lunch or after school, or I think that traditionally we think that that is always a positive, because then that's an extra, extra dip with the teacher, and it's a smaller student to teacher ratio, or it might just be 1-to-1. And that actually might help with the teacher to student relationship, but it doesn't help with the student to class relationship.
Right. So how do you help them become part of the community? And again, if you're doing that with all of the children, then that practice is fine. But if you're only doing it with these children, then again, it's another way that they look like an outsider or they look different. So it's just something for us to think about how to do that and how to do it well.
And to think about intention versus impact.
Yeah.
So one thing I want to say about this book is that I really appreciate how there are a lot of chapters, but the chapters are short. So you can read a chapter and digest it. What helps you is the stop and think questions that you have throughout. And then also it's like the book becomes your personal journal, because you have the try it. It's not just try it and like think about this question. It's try it. Here's a situation. What's your response going to be? And it expects you to write directly in the book. So it's inviting that additional reflection. So you don't have the potential excuse to say, oh, you know, I'll just highlight this right now, come back to it, or like mark off this page and I'll figure it out later. You have the space right there to do it.
Yeah, that was really important to me, that I feel that, you know, oftentimes I'll read books and I learn a lot from reading books. But when I interact with a book and I interact with other people in a book, I learn a lot more. So it was important to me to write this in an interactive way. And I think if people don't just read it, but they write answers to some of those very hard questions, how would you do this? If we were to videotape your classroom, what would you learn about your teacher discourse? Like, I don't know if I want to know that. So some of the questions in there make you really stop and think about things you might not be thinking about.
One question I just turned to is, what would a fourth grade multilingual learner need to know to be successful at completing this task? And then underneath that, there's an example of comparing fractions. And this, I think, you know, you have the space and you have the white space also to think about this. And this helps you anticipate student responses. It helps you get into the five practices. Yeah. And it just, that one question helps you be a better teacher in this lesson that you're going into. And it's just all in how you approach and how you think about positioning. And I don't know that we would always think of these questions and you have that as an example. So then if you have a unit on fractions, you have that one example of a question. And then in the next lesson, you might think of your own, but it's based off of the starting point that you've given us.
Yeah. And, you know, teachers helped us write those questions. And then we also discussed those questions with teachers as we wrote the book. And so they would meet with us. We would discuss the questions. They would say, I'd be better this way, or, you know, this would make me think, you know. And so actually everything that's in the book, you know, we've done multiple times with teachers, and they would give us really good feedback. And I was always thinking about, if other teachers were to do this, you know, or other, your colleagues in your building were to do this, what questions you think? So I think the questions are really excellent questions, because teachers were part of the development process.
I think that's really important to have teachers involved, because teachers are ultimately the ones going into classroom every day.
Yeah. The third piece then is storylines. So that's the one we haven't talked about. So we've talked about positions and acts. So storylines, you can think of these as narratives. So these develop over time. So can you think about storylines of individual children you've encountered in your life? Maybe there's the little math genius in the school. Everybody knows who that math genius is. Maybe there's the child that is always off task in math. Some of these storylines and narratives get passed from grade level to grade level. And so sometimes these stick for a while. So, you know, what are the storylines and the messages about multilingual learners, you know, in each classroom, each school, each community, and their families? That's another thing, you know, to think about. So we're just starting a new project in 3 states where we're going to be doing positioning with parents. And I'm so excited about this project. It's going to be with the parents, the teachers, and the kids. Grades 3 through 5. So I'm very excited about this. So I've thought about positioning, you know, as a parent, but this will be my first time doing workshops with parents and teachers together. And I'm working with a research team in Maryland and Arizona and Missouri. So I think this will be very interesting. But I think one of the questions there is, you know, what are the storylines you would want about your children in mathematics? So when I've done parent workshops before in the past, I'll talk about, you know, I've heard parents say, you know, I was never good at math. And we've all heard this one, right? But we never hear them say, I was never good at reading, or I can't read. But once the kids get to algebra, it seems like algebra is that magic year where they're like, I'm out. You know, I can help with third grade math, but once you're in algebra, I'm done. You know, trying to get parents not to communicate, even if they can help their kids with algebra, like, you can help, you can ask questions. But what are these narratives even in our own lives as a parent with mathematics? So as we think about storylines, what are statements and messages about multilingual learners? You know, so, you know, it could be some of the ones I've heard that are negative. Let's see. They can't learn math until they learn English. Well, we know that's not true. And we know that children come here actually knowing a lot of math from other countries, you know, that they've learned in other countries. They just don't know the math in English. They know it in their first language, their native language, their country of origin language, you know. Or families, you know, they don't want to come to parent night. You know, there's this assumption that they're not showing up at the school functions because they don't want to be there, when oftentimes there's a lot of reasons they're not showing up, you know, at those events. So there are these storylines that you hear. And I think, you know, we're seeing this play out more in the media, not in mathematics, but in the media, right? Somebody says something on Twitter and all of a sudden this blows up. And so, you know, this has application in every aspect of life, let me just say.
I was thinking that exact same thing when you said that about the storylines or headlines. If we just read the headline of a child, then we're missing so much about them. The headline might not or the storyline that somebody else gives them might not even be true. And what you were, the one of the storyline examples that you gave about the math genius, that leads, in my eyes, leads to a fixed mindset for that child. So then that could lead to being afraid to make mistakes and not being willing to engage in any new activities or anything that they're not, any math that they've never seen before. They might shy away from that because they're afraid of no longer having that storyline.
Yeah. So, you know, I've heard, you know, multilingual learners are lazy, right? And, you know, they won't engage or they're too shy. A lot of times you'll see this, you might see this with some children that are shy and they're not speaking yet. And, you know, this narrative of shyness will come out. And so there's this assumption then that I'm not going to call on them because they're shy. So there are things like this, these storylines about children. And so one of the questions I often ask teachers is, are there storylines about the multilingual learners in your class or your school that you would like to alter? And so then, you know, then how, you know, if they're negative, how do you alter them and promote new ones? You know, or if they're positive, how do you continue to promote those positive ones? So, but storylines is the third part that's very critical to consider in position three.
The storylines are connecting most with your underlying principles that you have in your book. So it states four underlying principles. The asset-based and the empathy-based are the two that kept coming up in my mind when you were talking about storylines. And yeah, it's just so much to think about and every day so much to learn. But if we try to implement all of this at one time, I think that that might be too overwhelming, then we might just revert back to our old ways. If we pick one of these principles and try to add a little bit to that each day, or pick one of like focus on positioning, or what, like one aspect of positioning, and then gradually build on, it seems like that might be more manageable for anyone.
Yeah, I think I agree with that. The asset based, we think, is so important because we've just seen so much deficit language, deficit actions with this particular group of children, especially from specific countries. So it happens from some countries and continents more than other countries and continents. The empathy based, we really wanted whoever was engaging with the material to put themselves in the shoes of the children, the parents, or the teachers of these children. And I would often draw on experiences from my raising my own children. And so at one point, I moved my children twice across the country, and it was against their will. They did not want to leave either city, either time. And so I did this thing where I said to the teachers that were in the PD with me, I said, okay, imagine that your parent comes to you and tells you you're moving to Japan or pick a different country against your will, and you're going to be placed in this school, and you're there for the first day against your will. You didn't want to move. You didn't want to leave your friends and your family and everything that was comfortable and that you knew. And, you know, quite a few of them had to admit, I've never thought of it that way. I never thought that some of them are here against their will. And I said, you know, I moved my kids from Chicago to DC. It was against their will. And there was no language issue involved. They just, you know, all of a sudden it was very uncomfortable for them to start life over again. So can you put yourselves in the shoes of the children, of the parents, and consider different perspectives than what you maybe considered in the past?
So we step outside of ourselves. So I want to switch gears just a little bit to talk about districts that already have a viable curriculum resource to use, and teachers are invested in it. They're willing to use it in their classroom. In one of the chapters, you talk about how the goal is to amplify curriculum, not just seek to simplify it. And then the other quote is, as a teacher, it's important to recognize that even though you may use district-adopted curriculum materials, they may not include contexts that are relevant or meaningful for all of your students. And I highlighted that piece in particular because when we're thinking about districts that have that viable curriculum, it's sometimes viewed as a like, here you go. And so like you pick it up and you go, you move, or so you not necessarily turn the page in the book. Most districts don't have textbooks in that same turn a page way, but we might have a journal that's, or a student journal. So it's turning them to the next journal page and thinking about tasks in that way. But the curriculum is deemed sometimes as being already like ready to go, completely packaged, and nothing needs to be altered. But that's not the view that you all are taking. So can you tell us a little bit about why it's so important to still think about amplifying curriculum?
Yeah. So the Amplifying curriculum is in that, in the book, we cite Pauline Gibbons' book. So that's a phrase that she uses. And I think it's a great phrase. My PhD is in curriculum design. So this is something I'm pretty passionate about. I wrote math books earlier in my career. I've edited materials, math books. I've written kind of the English language learner support materials for math curriculum textbooks that are, you know, used in U.S. schools. So this is something that I know a lot about and I'm very passionate about. And I've seen many, many instances where curriculum can be done very well, and in other cases where curriculum can get in the way of the kids learning the math. And so I've been fortunate to work with teachers who, and had the support of their principals and superintendents, to really look at their curriculum and look at situations where lessons didn't go well, especially for multilingual children. And so in one case, I'm meeting with the teachers and they said, oh, this lesson last year did not go well. And, you know, as an elementary teacher, you only teach it once a year to one group of kids. It's not like secondary where they get to try it multiple times. So I'm like, well, can you give me a sense of why you think it didn't go well? And they go, I don't remember, and I didn't write any notes down, but it was a disaster. And so I go, okay, let me look at it. And so I looked at it and I was like, okay, I can see why this was a problem. And so the lesson involved places that people may eat. Okay. And so one of the options was dining room. So I happened to be in a community where the children didn't have dining rooms. And so I asked the entire class, you know, what is this? No one could answer it. So I said, could you guess what you think it might be? And I got one guess. Is that the room with the TV? So here you had probably an author with privilege that had a dining room and involved this. And it's being used in a classroom where they don't know what that is. They don't have an image for that. Then there was ice cream shop was another place where you could eat, but shop was spelled S-H-O-P-P-E, and the kids didn't know what that was. So there were all these contexts in this lesson that the kids couldn't begin to engage in the activity because they didn't know what these things were. And in this classroom, only 20% of the kids were multilingual learners. So this wasn't just the multilingual learners. These were the other kids too that happened to be in an environment, you know, these were not high income communities, right? So as I start working with teachers and lessons, and in some contexts, that class would have been just fine. But in other contexts, that lesson doesn't work. So then there was another district, another school, and they had this lesson on arrays, mathematical arrays. So we think of rows and columns of things. And so the teachers thinking of there were stamps in the lesson. And so, you know, I said, well, why don't you bring in some postage stamps of arrays, you know, from the post office? So she takes me up on the idea. She goes and she gets these sheets of stamps. And the children had never been to a post office. And so somebody said, are these food stamps? They didn't know what postage stamps were. And so she had to introduce this context to them. And again, in this case, there were only 3 multilingual learners out of the 25 kids in the class. So again, this is a large percentage of this class that did not know what postage stamps were. So a lot of times I think as adults, we write curriculum materials based on our experiences for children that haven't had those experiences. So as a teacher, we are then in a position where we have to introduce these contexts in ways that will have meaning and help the children build meaning for them. Or we have to change the context and still get at the math that's there. So if you're doing a baseball example and the children have no knowledge of baseball, it's going to be very hard to explain the game of baseball if you've had no experience with playing baseball.
You have to know your students too. And you have to look ahead at the lessons to see what types of contexts are coming up so that you can alter that context to something that's actually meaningful and relevant to them. And you're not just stuck in like 10 minutes into the lesson and everybody's getting frustrated.
So this has raised this question for me, what's the purpose of the context? And so I think some teachers would say, well, to engage students, to motivate them to learn, something that interests them. But a lot of times the contexts have no interest to our students. As somebody might say, you know, to be able to apply the mathematics, you know, to see that there's real world application. Like you could see why, you could see teachers coming up with lots of different purposes for contexts. So this has been eye-opening to teachers as they've really started to analyze when, you know, so when I was writing math books earlier in my career, I would go in and I would teach every day what we were writing. And if I had put a problem up and every hand went up at the same time, what did I know? I know it was me that was the problem as the author of that problem, because every child in the room didn't understand what I had just written on that problem. Now, if one child's hand went up, it probably wasn't the problem, but it was so fascinating when I was writing curriculum materials to see this and like, oh, there's something there that isn't quite right that's stumping all of them at the same time. So it's a great way to write math and to see what works, what doesn't work. So it's been eye-opening to me and to teachers to see when contexts become a problem. So I've had conversations with teachers. What interests your kids? What is a common experience they've all had? What's something that you could create that they would be interested in? And so in those conversations, what's come up? They've talked about events at the school. So for example, one teacher did this lesson around field day. All the kids, it's at the end of the year. They all knew what field day was. They all get very excited about field day. So she did this really nice thing on elapsed time in third grade on field day. They all go to the same dollar store that's in the neighborhood of the school. So we went in, I filmed a video of buying some things at the dollar store to do some money problems. And they're all like, oh, I've been to that. So she plays this 60-second video of me at the dollar store. Didn't cost anything. You can use your phone cameras now. And the kids got all really excited about writing math problems around what you could buy at this dollar store. Because again, it's in their neighborhood. They've all been there. They've had experiences there. Then we wanted some context where they hadn't been there before. And we wanted to introduce them to a new context. So we went down to a chocolate factory and we filmed buying chocolates in arrays in a box that she could then do math problems at. And then I go up to the chocolate factory where they're dipping caramel apples and putting them in arrays because she was getting this multiplication unit. And the kids all wanted to then go to this chocolate factory, right? So it's this new context. But then she was going to be doing a book that Kathy Fosno had written on the t-shirt factory. So this was going to be an introduction to factories that she was going to be able to tie into the curriculum materials that the district had adopted. And so then she showed a video of the Crayola crayon factory. Oh my gosh, the kids got so excited about that because they're third grade. They use crayons every freaking day. You know, so there are videos now that are all on YouTube. And again, some districts, there's YouTube. What can you show and can't download? But it's so easy now. There's no cost involved. You can introduce a video in literally 30, 60 seconds. And the kids all of a sudden have a new understanding of the context.
Yeah, so you can definitely introduce a shared context. And that's something that we can do really like starting tomorrow. There's so many videos, like you were saying.
You know, I saw it on Twitter today. There was one of our teachers that graduated from our program, and she lets her kids that are young children use her phone anytime during the day. They can go get her phone and take a photograph of something they've created that they want her to see. Because, you know, if you're dealing with kindergarten or first graders, right, they all want your attention to see what you've created. She can't get to everybody. So she tweeted out this image, or retweeted, I think, of, you know, what some of all the photos that are filled up on her phone. And this other kindergarten teacher who's got like 400,000 followers. So she's got a lot of followers on Instagram. She's like, wow, you're a brave teacher giving your phone to little kids, right? So, but you can see how kids get really excited when you start using images from their life Another strategy is the teachers that told stories about their own families, especially the multilingual learners, but I think all of the children really connected to. So it might have been about a spouse or a partner. It might have been about a child. It might have been about a parent. One time they were doing the t-shirt factory. She brought in her t-shirts and she held up one from college. And this one was from this fundraiser. And she told these stories about these t-shirts. And the kids got so excited about that. So, young children, elementary age, they're very excited about learning more about the teachers' lives and hearing some of those stories. And telling stories can get them really interested in content, mathematical contents.
And that's being more creative for everyone involved. And it seems like it's just more fun for the teacher, too.
Yeah.
You can get really creative with what you can do and what you can bring in to mm-hmm. help build context that they could actually touch and manipulate.
Right.
Yes. Thank you for your.
All right. Well, thank you. I appreciate your time and look forward to seeing you again someday.
Share this podcast with your friends and colleagues to keep the Kids Math Talk conversation going. You can always tweet me with questions or comments using the handle @KidsMathTalk. You can also head to my website, kidsmathtalk.com/podcast, for previous episodes of this podcast. And join us next week for another episode of the Kids Math Talk podcast.